The man who concocted the ending of Six Feet Under, and the beginning, and much of what happened in between, is Alan Ball. Before making Six Feet Under for HBO, Alan Ball won an Oscar for his screenplay for American Beauty, another character-driven comedy drama in which the central character dies. Ball started out as a playwright before shifting to TV and writing for sitcoms such as Grace Under Fire and Sybil. Terry spoke with Alan Ball in June 2001, shortly after Six Feet Under was launched. She began by asking him how HBO executives reacted when he showed them the completed pilot.
We had a meeting, and they said, it feels a little safe. It feels a little network. Could you make the whole thing just a little more screwed up? Well, I had never gotten a note like that in TV.
Right.
And I just sort of, you know, looked up at the ceiling and said, thank you, God. And I said, yeah, I can definitely screw it up. And I didn't go in and screw things up just for the sake of that. But, it, you know, when they said that to me, I sort of felt like I had carte blanche to really go into the nooks and crannies of these characters' psyches. And then it got really interesting.
Can you give us an example of something that was less screwed up initially that got more screwed up after you got that suggestion?
Well, in the pilot, you know, Nate meets Brenda at the airport and they have sex.
Just for people who aren't following the series, Nate is the brother. Okay,
he's the prodigal son. He's the oldest son,
right,
who left home because he did not want to go into the business.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been sort of a Peter Pan, you know, hippie, basically. And he comes home for the Christmas holidays. And his father's killed in a car accident on the way to the airport to pick him up. But in the pilot, he meets this woman on the plane, Brenda, and she's kind of very, very sexually assertive, and they end up having sex in a broom closet. And then in my original draft, she just was kind of really nice, and then she showed up at the funeral and said, you know, after Nate has this scene where he sort of insists on picking up the dirt actually with his bare hands and throwing it into the grave, as opposed to a more sanitized procedure that's standard for the funeral home. And she sees that and she sort of goes, wow, you know, that was really impressive. So she was just basically kind of like the nice girlfriend, you know. And so I went back and I made her a little more brittle and a little more mysterious, and put in a phone call where, you know, she calls him and, you know, just to check out how he's doing. And he sort of flirts with her and says something along the lines of, you know, he sort of like calls her on some of her stuff. And she just snaps and says to him, you think you're not easy to read? You know, guys like you are good for, you know, a roll in the hay, and that's it. And she hangs up the phone. It just sort of makes it more complicated.
Well, why don't we play back that phone call that you just described?
Hello?
Well, it's about to start raining frogs here. How are things on your end?
God, I'm glad you called.
Really? Why?
I don't know. Because you, thought you had a calming effect on me?
Are you familiar with the psychological term projection?
Oh, are you familiar with the psychological term me? Come on. You grew up with all that psychobabble. Rebelled against it every chance you got, still do. And that includes having sex with strangers in closets at airports.
And you think you're not easy to read? Coasting by on your looks and charm isn't working like it used to, but you have no idea what else to do because you've never had to learn. Any woman with half a brain looks at a guy like you and thinks, good for a hot but believe me, that's it.
Alan Ball, I'm glad you brought up the character of Nate's girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Because in some ways, I still don't know what to make of her. I don't know whether she's a kind of really smart person, a life force, or whether she's really troubled, whether she's beneath all of this, a really troubled person who's going to do a lot of damage as the series plays out.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want me to be confused?
At this point, yeah. A lot about Brenda gets explained over the course of the first season, a lot of why she is the way she is. Is explained and you understand where she comes from. And she's also underneath that, she's incredibly vulnerable, much more than she would even like to admit to herself. And we eventually get to that place. But what was interesting to me about Nate and Brenda, as opposed to, you know, the traditional, they're kind of like the Hope and Michael from 30-something of our show. But the traditional sort of main couple of a show is usually very well-adjusted and very, you know, committed and very good about expressing their feelings. And these are two people who don't have any experience in a long-term relationship for their own reasons. And they're both smart and they're both good people, but they don't necessarily have the skills to maintain a relationship. But they're both at points in their lives where they kind of want to do that. And I also think, you know, in my mind, overlooking the entire course of the series, there's a little bit of fate involved in the two of them being together.
Now, I find that I usually resist new series until after a couple of episodes or more, the characters finally get under my skin, and mm-hmm. I get really interested in them. I think I have a very crowded brain that feels already overpopulated with characters and plot
Absolutely.
Lines.
Absolutely, yeah.
Do you think of yourself as having to fight against that when you're writing a pilot? Because in the pilot, you have to do a lot of work. You have to not only make it interesting, but you have to introduce a whole cast of characters, introduce mm-hmm. the basic plot of the series, mm-hmm. and keep resistant people like me interested.
Mm-hmm. One of the great things about working at HBO as opposed to working at the broadcast networks, just based on my own limited experience with the broadcast networks, is that HBO is constantly encouraging me to really get into the character psyches and get into the stuff that's not so pretty, the warts, the neuroses. And as a writer, I've always been drawn to those characters because, well, number one, I can relate to them more than I can relate to, like, the perfect heroes or heroines. And number two, my heart goes out to them. I love characters who are trying to make sense of their lives and trying to live an authentic life in an increasingly inauthentic world, but they're not totally equipped and they're just kind of acting on blind faith and, you know, really, you know, making mistakes and their lives are messy. I find that much more poignant and much more captivating than, you know, your totally perfect hero or your completely nurturing, you know, wife, mother, heroine, that kind of thing. I just don't, those archetypes don't interest me. And plot actually doesn't interest me as much as character. And so in the pilot of 6 Feet Under, I felt like, you know, there's nothing like a death, a cataclysmic event to really bring, it just sort of peels away a layer of skin. And you get to see how people really are underneath the armor that they wear through daily life and the masks that they wear through daily life. And those are the moments to me that are always interesting. And usually pilots I've worked on before, there's so much studio involvement, there's so much network involvement, and you're constantly being told to spoon feed information about the characters to the audience, whereas at HBO it was just like, just let the behavior speak for itself.
Now, I'll tell you something that surprised me. At the end of the latest episode, episode 4, mm-hmm. several people at the end of the show actually seem to learn a lesson and grow. You know, a gang leader learns to have empathy with his dead homie's parents. Mm-hmm. The daughter seems to learn she probably doesn't want to flirt with gangs and guns. Mm-hmm. And David, the brother who's been in the business for a while, mm-hmm. kind of learns a lesson from the corpse. I should say here that the corpse usually talks to
well, David's the guy who
people
spends
in the funeral home.
Yeah, he spends a lot of his time with dead people, you know, and that of course is not meant, I'm not implying that these people are actually ghosts. These are manifestations of interior dialogues that he's having with himself,
right?
But yeah, I mean, you know, I think as you watch the series, people do learn lessons and then they backtrack. You know, it's one step forward, two steps back. But, while I feel like a lot of the lesson learned moments in network TV seem to me very saccharine and very superficial, I don't think that one should necessarily just try to avoid those moments altogether, because we do learn lessons in life. But what we attempt to do is for it to be tempered, for it to be realistic. But people have profound moments in their lives. And in a show that is about how the constant presence of death throws your own life into stark relief, I think people will have profound moments. Are you familiar with the writer Thomas Lynch?
Yeah, the poet who's also an undertaker.
Yeah, well, you know, I did a lot of research when I started working on the show, and his books had the most profound effect on me just in terms of the tone of how they were written. And there's a certain reverence for life, but at the same time, just a completely unsentimental acceptance of the fact that it is fleeting. And so I think that's what I'm attempting to do in the moments where people, you know, people do learn things. People do become aware of things. People's consciousnesses expand. But at the same time, it's a constant struggle, because you always want to fall back.
You know, you described the series about living in the constant presence of death. And I know that death really entered your life. I'm not sure if it was for the first time or not, when you were 13. Mm-hmm. And your sister was killed in a car accident. You were both in the car at the time she was driving. Mm-hmm. Could I ask you to tell what happened?
Well, my life was very clearly separated into before and after at that moment. She was driving me to a music lesson, and it was her 22nd birthday, and she pulled out in front of a car, and it hit the driver's side, and she was killed instantly, and I was not hurt at all. It was profoundly shocking and traumatic moment in my life, and you know, I will carry deep scars from that moment until the day I die. And then there was a lot of blood, and in the ambulance I said, "Is she going to be okay?" And instead of just telling me, "No, she's dead," they said, yes, she's going to be okay. They took me to the hospital, and I was I was thinking, well, she's going to be okay. She's going to be okay. I was holding on to that. And then our family doctor came and picked me up and was driving me back to meet my parents. And he said, "You're going to have to be strong for your parents." And I said, "Well, why? You know, she's going to be okay, isn't she?" And he said, "No." And there was a moment where a very distinct physical sensation of just the bottom dropping out from under me at that moment. And my family, I wouldn't call them dysfunctional, because there was no abuse or no addictions or anything like that. But certainly we were not particularly skilled in intimacy. And what happened is that everybody sort of splintered and went into their own little world. And I think that's certainly, there is a dynamic of that in the Fishers, in that people really kind of, even though they're a family and they share the same house, they exist separate, as separate entities. And that to me is what gives the show fertile ground, because as these people move towards each other and start to reach out to each other, that's, I think, where you can really mine that for some great drama and some great comedy.
What was your sister's funeral like?
It was surreal. It was very surreal. It was, you know, the traditional open casket thing. And I remember the first time I saw her in the open casket, I thought, okay, who's that? Because they had done her completely different. They'd given her like big boofy hair, which she never wore in life. It was like a lipstick color that she would never wear. And I'm sorry, you know, when they lay those bodies out in caskets, they look phony. They look like wax figures. And it's certainly for me, and that's all I'm saying. I'm not saying that this is true for everybody. It was not at all comforting to see that. And there was a point where my mom just broke down and started to cry, and somebody from the funeral home just appeared out of nowhere and silently swooped her off into this room and shut the drape. And that moment is very – I put that moment in the pilot because I'll never forget that, because the subtext of that moment is, oh, these emotions are – it's – they're – no, you shouldn't see this. This is bad. You shouldn't have this kind of emotion. The way that we should deal with this is very quiet, very muffled. Keep everything down. Well, no, that's a lie, because what you need to do is you need to scream. You need to bang on the wall. You need to, like, tear at your hair. Because grief is a primal, primal thing, and the only way out of it is through it. And, you know, it took me 25 years to learn that, because I never really grieved for my sister, because, number one, I was told to stay strong for my parents. Number two, I just didn't have the skills. I didn't know what you were supposed to feel, how you were supposed to express it. It was too overwhelming. It was too terrifying. And so I carried that grief, that unexpressed grief, around for 20 years.
Well, you know, I thought maybe I could play a scene here. You know, you're talking about the importance of grief and how, like, at your sister's funeral, the funeral director tried to cover that up by escorting your grieving mother behind behind a curtain. There's a scene I want to play from the end of an episode, because it's the first episode, in which the father's being buried, and the one of the sons, the prodigal son who's come back, wants to throw fistfuls of dirt onto the coffin, as opposed to, as you describe it, the more sanitized, symbolic version of throwing dirt onto the coffin, which is what this funeral home usually practices. And his brother, who has been in the funeral business for a while, gets really angry with him for acting out like that, and for showing his anger and grief in public. And this is the conversation they have between them about what the appropriate way to behave is.
You want to be the alpha dog, Nate? Is that it? You're coasting toward midlife with nothing to show for it. Now you want to come back and be the rock for this family to lean on? F*** you.
That is not what I'm...
You want to get your hands dirty? You sanctimonious prick, talk to me when you've had to stuff formaldehyde-soaked cotton up your father's ass so he doesn't leak.
Jesus.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you just would have tossed him out with the garbage. It may seem weird to you, but there is a reason behind everything that we do here. We provide people with a very important and sacred service at the darkest time in their lives, because maybe they don't want to make a spectacle of themselves, because maybe they prefer to grieve in private.
Why? Why does it have to be such a secret? It's nothing to be ashamed of. Dave, please.
Pat, you know nothing. Nothing. You had a responsibility to this family, and you ran away from it, and you left it all for me.
Whoa, don't blame me if you're not living the life you want. That is nobody's fault but your own.
Okay. Fine, just do me a favor, okay? You got out. Stay out.
Is there anything you want to say about writing that scene, Alan Ball?
Well, I think there's, because I think they both have valid viewpoints. I don't think Nate is the hero and David is the villain at all, because Nate is so self-righteous when he's telling David, you can't go through this without getting your hands dirty. He's telling this to a man who constantly, you know, who constantly prepares dead bodies. And that's what Nate was afraid of and Nate ran away from. And in David's mind, of course, he abdicated his responsibility and left David with no choice but to go into this business. I think it's – I also think, you know, the thing about the relationship between Nate and David is that the bedrock of that relationship is just this fierce love for each other. But because of the various ways that their lives have taken them, they can't communicate that. And so that passion gets rechanneled into anger and resentment.
Alan Ball, speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. He's the creator of Six Feet Under and wrote and directed Sunday's final episode.